Welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. We have a very large audience today, and I know that many of you are here because you heard today's guest, Dr. Harold Rode, back in May when he spoke about Turkey's interest in the Islamization of Jerusalem. Turkey, I believe, will figure into today's program as well. Before we get to Harold, let me introduce the JPC and our work. We are a 501c3 organization providing perspectives and analysis of foreign policy and defense and domestic policy by leading scholars, academics, and commentators. We support strong American defense, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We will defend Israel's legitimacy and security against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity, which right now needs a little defense. In this series of calls, we've been very pleased to bring you scholars and policymakers on issues including China, China in Hong Kong, China in the Middle East, China as a security issue between the United States and Israel. We have also done things aside from China. We have done the application of Israel's sovereignty in Judea and Samaria, the Abraham Accords, Iran sanctions, and a side trip to talk about the United States Supreme Court. What we have today is the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan and the assorted players there. There are a lot of players there, and Harold is going to talk to us about them. Remember before we begin that you are muted, but you can send questions during the presentation. You can send them to our info@jewishpolicycenter.org email address, or better yet, use the Q&A function on your Zoom screen. That's a Q&A function on your Zoom screen. Our guest is, as I said, Harold Rode, an expert on Islam and its many permutations. He doesn't want me to do the whole address, the whole introduction, but I'm going to do it because I think people need to hear this. A protege of the great scholar and historian Bernard Lewis and former senior official in the Pentagon, Harold has dedicated his life to exploring Islam and its historical richness. He has lived and studied in Iran, Turkey, and many parts of the Arab world. As a Pentagon official working in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, he observed the reemergence of Islam and the threat that it could pose to liberal democracies around the world. He received his PhD in Ottoman history from Columbia University, and he is currently a Distinguished Senior Fellow of the Gatestone Institute and the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. And lest you think that all of this is kind of esoteric and it doesn't apply to what we do today or how we feel today, let me remind you that in May of 2003, we were in the middle of the Iraq War. Harold was working for the Pentagon in post-Saddam Iraq when over 2,700 books and tens of thousands of documents related to 2,300 years of Jewish life in Iraq, which ended in the middle of the 20th century, were discovered in the flooded basement of the Iraqi intelligence headquarters by the United States Army. Harold was intimately involved in the initial recovery, freezing, shipping, and vacuum freeze drying the material to prevent mildew and other kinds of damage, and the identification and restoration of the materials, which ultimately were displayed in the US National Archive. So with that as an and he's also, by the way, an author for In Focus magazine on occasion, and we are very grateful. With that, Harold, I turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you, Shoshana. I appreciate your introduction. You were wrong to use such a big one. In the end, we're all very simple people just trying to understand the world, that's all. Anyway, this Azerbaijan, which I will say Azeri. Azeri, shortened for Azerbaijan, and Shoshana, you must realize that you said Azerbaijan, which shows you're a Russian imperialist, because the Azeris have a J, and they want to be known as Azerbaijan and no Z or anything like this. This may sound silly, but believe me, these little words, these little pronunciations from all the peoples that we're dealing with in the Middle East and the Caucasus here matter, and they could start a fight or sometimes a battle and sometimes may even a war over this. So I want to talk about Azerbaijan and Armenia, which I know to the outside world sounds unbelievably complicated. But in order to try to make sense of it, and frankly, to tell you the truth, I've been living this, I don't know, since the early 1980s. So I have some thoughts. A few things just as a background context in the beginning. Number one, we look at borders as permanent and that they mean something. For example, the border between the United States and Canada. None of us can really imagine that that's going to change. It sounds absurd to us. But in the part of the world, the Islamic world, in this case, Southern Caucasus, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, these borders have nothing to do with ethnicity, who's here and who's there. They don't have to do with religion. They have to do with politics and power. Now, just another thing on the Azerbaijan thing, which is really important to show you, there is this word that we have, Turkish. And when we think of Turkish, we think of Turkey. But there is another word used when it comes to the anybody outside of Turkey. It's called Turkic. And instead of ish, it's ik. Well, that was invented in the 19th century by the Russians who were moving into Central Asia in the area that we call the Stans. And that they were trying to make a distinction, a division between the Turkish-speaking people or Turk-speaking people in Central Asia and in Turkey. So they invented this difference. And it plagues people like me because I know that in their mind, they have one word to describe themselves. It's called Turk. There's no ish and ik in their language. They don't see them, these distinctions, as big differences. This again was a political decision to come up with Turkish and Turkic. And one more, and it's absolutely essential here. And Michael, I'd ask you to show the map, which has Armenia and Azerbaijan. If you could put that up on the screen, please. No, keep going. There we go. Yes, thank you. Now, the question is, if you look throughout Soviet Central Asia, or former Soviet Central Asia, and the Caucasus, you will see a lot of borders which look like this. Look at this. The tan color, Azerbaijan, you see, is a big thing on the right of the map. And then if you look at the center left at the bottom, you'll see another tan thing. That's also Azerbaijan. Now look at Armenia. It has this little corridor which goes down, the area down below is Iran, and it cuts off the two sections of Azerbaijan. Why do something like this? When these, if you wish, there were Soviet republics, which today became, when the end of the Soviet Union became countries, why do this? And they were done basically by Stalin. The answer is divide and conquer. Watch this. If you look at these borders, I mean, they're absolutely crazy. There is no difference between the peoples on all sides of this border, on the borders that you see here. Now, Nagorno-Karabakh, and it's a little hard for me because we can't use a pointer here. If you go into the tan area between the last day in Armenia and the first day in Azerbaijan, you see, look, there's a tan area, a little tan area. Nagorno, which is a Russian word meaning mountainous, Karabakh, is the white area in the middle there. The white area, or bluish, whitish, that area has had in it before the earlier Azerbaijani Armenian war. It had parts of it were overwhelmingly Armenian. For example, the area completely surrounded by the Tan. And there was overwhelmingly Armenian, but it was in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. And so it became part of Azerbaijan. And in the area to its left, that is the tan area on the left, there were a lot of Azeris. And this just went nuts, meaning that you cannot divide this area into nationalities, into religions. Armenia is Christian. Azerbaijan is Shiite Muslim. You'll see how nothing fits into our whole system of trying to understand Shiite, Sunnis, Turks, whatever, in a moment. But the area was on purpose confused. Why did they do this? Why did Stalin do this when he created these borders? He wanted that, for example, in this case, the little area, the area surrounded, you see it's again light blue, surrounded by the tan, all of which was part of Iran. But they knew that Stalin knew that he needed a people to look to the central government, to Stalin, for help against the Azerbaijanis. And what he did was create all over the former Soviet Union, but especially in the southern areas, these republics where they put some people in one and some in another, and it guaranteed trouble. One more thing, and then I want to deal with the people in the different countries that support the different sides here. It's extremely important that in the Middle East, the concept of war and fighting. We in the West, and especially, unfortunately, our diplomats, try to impose the American view of the world on everybody. We want to get to a solution. You've heard this phrase, are you part of the solution or are you part of the problem? I guess it's in reverse. Well, unfortunately, I've been told all the time that I'm part of the problem. Why? Because I know that there are no solutions in the Middle East. There are temporary, there are truces, there are ceasefires. No one ever gives up. You don't let bygones be bygones. You keep this anger and frustration inside of you. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's, from our point of view, it's terrible. But from their point of view, that's the way they live their life. If an Azerbaijani, for example, let's say the president of Azerbaijan, if he gives up on mountainous Nagorno-Karabakh, which is again overwhelmingly our Armenian, he will be called by his people a traitor, a traitor with a T. And if the Armenians would give up that little, again, that little area totally surrounded by Azerbaijan, they too would be called traitors by their people. Now, you want to know how long this is going to go on? Until, I think, what was it, in 1949, the Quakers in Philadelphia said, what's if these Jews and Arabs would just sit down like two good Christians and solve everything, everything would work. But they aren't, and they're not going to. And that is not what Armenia and Azerbaijan are going to do either. So instead of understanding this, it's, oh my God, what do we, how do we solve the whole thing? How do we just manage the problem? Now we have the State Department that loves to manage situations. There is no way to solve this, to end the problem. It just doesn't work. That's the Middle East. How do you explain the fact that there are, for example, there are all these Palestinian refugees. I think some of them are fourth or fifth generation refugees. It's, you keep conflicts festering. It's all over the Muslim world. So that is the framework now that we're going to try, or I'm going to try to explain why the different countries support the people that they do. Well, we know there's no love lost between Turks and Armenians. We know, for example, just listen and watch, Erdogan, the dictator of Turkey, hates Armenia and also hates Armenians. He says and does all sorts of things in a secret language called Turkish that, again, our people don't know. And I've been in a personal situation with him once where he went off on a group in Turkey, which is not Sunni. It's a Muslim group, but not Sunni. And he didn't know there was someone there listening to him who understood him. These are permanent problems. Now, why do the Turks not like the Armenians? Well, you can say they massacred them, as they did in before and during World War I. And there's a blood feud there, and the Turks never admit they did anything. That doesn't mean they're individual Turks that don't admit they are, but not the Turkish government, because if they were to admit that they did awful things to the Armenians, well, then they would be held responsible. And in the Middle East, there is no word for responsible. There's only a word for blame. And if I am blamed for something, I'm a bad guy, I am shamed. What does shame mean? Not the English word. Shame means not what I think about me, but what others say about me. And I think I could sum up the Middle East in general by saying, you know, we have this phrase, or at least when I grew up, and I'm 71 years old, there was this phrase, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names will never hurt me. In the Middle East, it's the opposite. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will definitely hurt me. It's more important to keep your reputation. Reputation means what others say about you, than to live. And that is why Saddam Hussein, when he died, refused to admit anything. He was till the end. It's better to die and keep your reputation than others call you all sorts of awful things and make fun of you. That's the key to all of this. Now, let's look at this unending conflict. Let's just call it, if we can make a distinction between a war, we'll say maybe should end in a peace, that you put bygones be bygones. There's no way to say that in any Middle Eastern language. By the way, I take out Hebrew here, because Hebrew is Israel, and Hebrew, the Hebrew language, are Western. They have Western concepts. None of these people do. None of them. And it's not just the Muslims. You're the Armenians, and you have to understand, if you understand it from their point of view, they're right. And if you understand the Azeris, they're right from their point of view. Let's look at the outside powers and whom they support. Let's start with Russia. Russia in the 19th century, and it's the source of the Armenian massacres, that is the Turks who massacred the Armenians. What the Russians did, most of Eastern Turkey at that time and today, a large section, was Armenian. Now, the Turks wanted to destroy the Ottoman Empire, and the Russians are Christian. The Armenians are Christian. They're not exactly the same type of Christian, but they're Eastern Christians, not Catholic or not Protestant. And the Russians basically helped the Armenian intellectuals, and those were in the Ottoman Empire, to try to say, we want an independent Armenian state in the territory of what is Turkey, in our traditional God knows where. And the Turks understood this as an existential threat, and that's where that happened. Now, and it's a shame, because the Armenian people in and of themselves weren't involved in all this intellectual stuff. But in the Middle East, if you're unsure of somebody, you always look for some bad things to say, and that's what the Russians basically precipitated in Armenia. And that's why the Turks did what they did, because they felt that the Armenians, in essence, really the Russians, were the ones who wanted to take over their country. And it's a shame. And by the way, a lot of the people in Eastern Turkey, and even among the upper classes of Turkey, are descendants of especially children who were lost in the awful things that were going on in Eastern Turkey, what was happening to the Armenians. And they were taken in by local Kurdish and Turkish families and raised as Muslims. Prime Minister Özal of Turkey, I have every reason that he's long dead. He died in, I think, was it the early 90s, if I'm correct, or in the 90s. By something he told me, it was clear that he was of part Armenian descent. A lot of Turks are, but they were taken in by Muslim families, and they were made Muslims, and their descendants are Turks today. Anyway, Russia has this traditional relationship with Armenia, and Russia is supplying Armenia with all sorts of arms. And Azerbaijan, hey, well, let me just go on a bunch of other things. Now watch this. India, you say, what does India care? It's so far away. India also supports Armenia because who's Armenia's real big enemy? It's Turkey. You know what Erdogan is doing? He's taking what were peaceful Sunni Islamic Indian leaders and training them to be hardcore fundamentalists in Turkey and sending them back to India and therefore creating unrest among Indian Muslims. Again, 80% of which are Sunni, 20% are Shiite. Maybe I'll get the wise whatever later. Pakistan, India's arch rival, starts, and by the way, a gentleman just wrote, Erdogan is doing the same in Lebanon, 100%. Yeah, Erdogan basically wants to take over the Sunni world and then the entire Muslim world. And I, if I can quote him, this is him. Again, he does not speak English, but here's, I'm going to read a quote. He's, our civilization, by which he means Muslim civilization, Turkish civilization, our civilization of what, of conquest. We'll see many times in a ceremony that Turks have a sword in their hand. The Saudi flag has a sword, Islam. Interlocutors, Turkish conquest is not occupation or looting. It's spreading the justice of Allah. Well, that's very nice. I'm glad that the justice of Allah is being spread. But let's just be honest with what is going on here. It's, you know, now, Pakistan, the upper class of Pakistan is originally ancestrally from Central Asia. Central Asia are what we call the stand steady, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, whatever like that. And the upper class of Pakistan is Turk. They call it, you'd hear Turkic. And they have and have always had a natural affinity towards Turkey. For example, the residence of the American ambassador in Turkey is on Ali Jinnah Street. What is Ali Jinnah? He was the leader who founded, the Indian Muslim who founded Pakistan. Anyway, so here you have the Pakistanis who are supporting their Turkish, their Turkey ally. That's just whatever you say. You see, even the words, it's hard to express in English. Now, where does Israel fit in? Israel's in a bind. And I want to just take a little diversion and say that, you know, at times during the Soviet era, the KGB and the CIA cooperated on small projects here and there because on certain small projects, they had common interests. And in here you have an interesting, well, on one hand, Israel is supplying weaponry to Azerbaijan. Why? Because independent Azerbaijan, the one that is fighting Armenia right now, is run by a secular dictator. All these countries are dictators, basically. A secular man who his grave enemy is Iran. Now, Israel and Iran, but excuse me, Israel and Azerbaijan share exactly the same enemy. Now, Israel has supplied some military technology to Azerbaijan, but it puts Israel in a very tight spot because Israel has absolutely no interest in a problem with Armenia. Israel knows what it's like to be a people that is oppressed. I mean, the Jewish people, look what the Nazis did. And in fact, Hitler said when he wanted to, he was talking to his generals and his those around him before before 1939, he said, look, if we kill all the Jews, it won't make any difference because the West won't care. They never cared about the Armenians, and the Armenians are Christian. And there's something to this. So Israel shares an emotional bond also with the Armenians. So this sort of war is a terrible thing for Israel because it feels with Azerbaijan a particular interest, and there is a Jewish community in Azerbaijan which lives quite freely and quite openly. It's not a problem. And it wants good relations with Armenia. So what do you do? This is the situation that, you know, countries are forced to deal with. Now, Turkey here is an odd way. Certain, as I said, supports Azerbaijan. Turkey is Sunni, that is the rulers of Turkey. It's about, I don't know, 40-50%. Actually, it's a little more Sunni. But, and Azerbaijan is Shiite. And the things that Sunnis say, their words about Shiites, are absolutely disgusting. So is there a natural affinity here? Well, the enemy is my friend. And Armenia clearly is an enemy of Turkey. Armenia is actually trying to get along with Turkey, but Turkey makes it rather difficult. And again, it's not Turkey. We're talking about the leadership of Turkey. Now, where do we, just I think one or two more things. Now, why is Iran, and by the way, Iran, Shiite, Muslim Iran, what side do you think it supports? I hope you won't be surprised with all the craziness that I've explained up to now. It supports Armenia, Christian Armenia. Now, why? All this is logical in their terms. Iran is an empire. It is a territory filled with many, many ethnicities and somewhat fewer but religious groups. There are no reliable statistics on the ethnicity of Iran. But from my experience, Shoshana mentioned, I studied in Iran. I went to university in Iran. Now, when I went there the first time, Iran, I spoke Turkish better than Persian. And Turkish and Azeri are really almost, not totally, but mutually intelligible. They're the same language. They're just called by different names. And here I was, I flew from Israel. That shows again, it's a long time ago. And I flew to Israel, from Israel to Tehran. I get off the airport of the airplane. I knew Persian grammar, but I didn't know how to speak Persian. The language supposedly is the major language of Iran. Now, the time I was in Tehran, for about 2 weeks. I started to learn to put the Persian language together. But about 8 in 10 people had no problem speaking Azeri with me. They spoke Azeri. I spoke Turkish. That's like someone from the Mississippi Delta speaking to someone where I come from. Shoshana and I are from Philadelphia, basically. And we can understand each other. Maybe there are a few expressions, but it's the same. Okay, what is Iran's problem? There are no real figures, population, because the governments don't tell us, and the United Nations and the CIA handbook, they don't know what they're talking about. I can only talk from personal experience, because I remember when I worked for the government, I read the handbook on Iran. Here's the bottom line. I, from my experience, believe that all of northwestern Iran and the map that Michael just put up, if you look up where the red area is, that whole area in, it says Azeris in Iran, minority in the lower left, it is wrong. I can't prove this, there's no way of proving it, that the largest ethnic group in Iran is Azeri. It's not Persian. That's from my experience in being able to talk. It's not scientific. There are no scientific numbers. But these Azeris in Iran believe that they are the pure Iranians who in 1401, a Turkish ruler came and cut out 400,000 tongues and made them speak Turkish. This is garbage. It's not true, but they believe it. So the Iranian Azeris believe they're the true Iranians, even if their native language or their parents' native language is Azeri Turkish and not Persian. And they're the strongest Persian nationalists that I know. Now, when Azerbaijan, Soviet but former now independent Azerbaijan, which has about a fourth of the Azeris in the world, between two-thirds and three-quarters of the Azeris in the world live in Iran. Now, the Khamenei, the Führer of Iran, the supreme leader, and that's the best translation from Persian Rahbar of his title, Führer, because he is that. Khamenei is an Azeri. He's not a Persian. Anyway, they are the people, when Soviet Azerbaijan became the independent republic, all these Azeris are coming to me and saying, hey, maybe, how can we help the Azeris of Iran join us and we can become this big Azeri republic? And what they found, unfortunately, is when they talked to Iranian Azeri, they said, no, we're Azeri, but we're Iranian. But you could join us because you're Iranian too. And it, of course, made them very upset. So if the Independent Republic of Azerbaijan succeeds, it is an existential threat to the territorial integrity of Iran. And that is why Iran supports Muslim Iran, Shiite Muslim Iran, supports Christian Armenia against Shiite Muslim Azerbaijan. Now, I understand this is all complicated. It's more convoluted than complicated. That's the bottom line. I hope this confusing introduction, and I did my absolute damnedest to be as clear as possible. But Shoshana, you, everybody else, please, you now shoot me with questions, and I'll do my damnedest to try to understand, try to explain. But you never know.
We're not interested in shooting you, Harold. given that you have a pot with so many different countries and people, and as you say, this is a kind of permanent problem. Let's go to the first question that we have here. If we're going to try to manage the problem, we, the international community, to manage the problem as opposed to solving the problem, is the goal then to get all of those other guys out of the middle, to have the Turks stop supplying weapons and the Iranians stop supplying weapons and see where the Russians go? Is the goal to get other people out? Is that the best you can do?
Can I ask, and your brilliant husband this morning published an article in which he's showing that Turkey is using F-15s to bomb Armenia in this little war. Just to add one more thing. We could do whatever we want, Shoshana. There was already a large population transfer in the first Armenia-Azerbaijan war, which was, I can't remember, I think it was in the 90s or maybe the 2000s, something. I am a historian, but we're not good with dates sometimes. But it's an ongoing thing. It sounds, well, there's been a large population exchange already. But here's the problem. I'm a Middle Easterner for this. Yeah. I cannot say, let bygones be bygones. I want to compare the Hebrew word and Arabic word for what we hear as peace. Shalom. Everything in Hebrew and in Arabic, they're really variants of the same language. I know they don't sound it today. Everything is three-letter roots. So the word shin, lamed, mem, those three letters mean completeness in Hebrew. Shalem means completed. Leshalem means to pay in Hebrew. Well, what is paying? Shana hands me what I just bought from her, and I hand her money. It's over. The money, therefore, completed the transaction. Shalom in Hebrew comes from the same origin. It means it's over. What was, was. What's mine is now is mine, and what is yours, and we don't have a fight. We don't try to fight each other. Arabic, which is the basic Middle Eastern language of Islam, the word salam has nothing to do with that. Salam, all it means is the joy that one gets submitting to Allah's rule through Islam. Islam itself means submission. It has nothing to do with peace. They have no concept in Arabic, Turkish, or Persian of the concept that we have in the West and Israel has of bygones being bygones. So what do? What you basically try to do is come up with some silly truce. I say silly because it can't last until the next time it happens. It's people in Azerbaijan and people in Armenia cannot give up on what happened to them. There are a lot of things that happened to me in my life, and Shoshana in your life, and everybody else who's listening in Turkey. Turks have a very serious problem with letting go. I'm sorry, I'm sorry if I say I'm sorry. I'm shaming myself. I can see from some of the names popped up, we have a few wonderful Turks. I know some of the names that have appeared here already.
Okay.
It is.
But the same is true, excuse me, as I recall, in the Balkan Wars, when they talked about the Battle of Kosovo Poli in 1382. There are just people and places that you don't get past. But this then raises a question asked by several of our listeners. What was the trigger this time? Was there something specific that happened you know, every so and so it pops out. Was there a trigger this time?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. And here's why I don't know. Because imagine the following. The Middle East is like a pail of gas-soaked rags. And a little boy flipping lit matches onto that pail or into the pail. Now, gasoline doesn't explode, but the fumes do. You know that one of those matches is eventually, because the fumes are coming out, is going to explode the whole pail, but you don't know which one. So the idea of stopping little small incidents, it's like putting your finger, with Johnny putting his finger in the dike. It can't happen. You do your best, and what it requires, and unfortunately Israel has had to learn this, and it learned it very early, is you basically must at all times remain strong, which means you arm yourself in whatever way you possibly can. That's why the Azeris are buying the weapons they are. That's why the Armenians, who have basically no money, are trying to get whatever they can from the Russians, who have been very good at supplying them. But these are never-ending things. And the idea, oh, you have an agreement that you signed that you won't, your F-16s, you will not, of course, Turkey's part of NATO, but it therefore won't have Soviet weapons. But there's a reason to believe that the S-400 missiles were used, I think, in Syria, and I think also in Azerbaijan. Well, that shouldn't be if they're a NATO power. But so, and we love written agreements. Now watch this. In Middle East, the Arabic word for something which is written like in a copy book or on paper, defter, it's defter. Now defter, in Persian, it means an office. The word is also still used in Turkish, but it's interesting the origins in this word, because it applies to this conflict and everything else. It comes from an ancient Greek word, defterios. I do not know Greek, which means secondary. I learned this from the great Bernard Lewis, because he knew everything. I mean, it's unbelievable. I was so fortunate to be in his life. That's all I could, let's put it that way. Anyway, if it's secondary, what is written is secondary. It's oral testimony which matters. That's why, for those of you who are Jews, you have a ketubah, a marriage contract, and you have to have two witnesses. And why those witnesses are listed is if something goes wrong, they know who to call to testify. That's why it's there. It's a Middle Eastern view of the world. Shoshana, I'm sorry. I know I've gone far afield, but...
No, you're where we want to be, because we keep getting questions, you know. And a couple of our listeners, probably American listeners, have made a suggestion that population exchanges might be helpful here, or, you know, reconfiguring Armenia and Azerbaijan to keep the people most like one another, closest to one another. What is the possibility? Because I think that's a seriously American way to approach the problem. Can you fix it with transfers? Can we fix this problem?
No.
And if not, what can we do? Can we be helpful?
Wait a minute. Let's look at the Israel-Palestinian thing for idea of transfers. What's the story here? More Jews from the Arab world came to Israel than Muslims who left, what they today call Palestinians, left from what is today Israel. That was a population exchange of which you could say is 1948. The Arabs, thank God, we're seeing a new trend. Let's hope it continues with the UAE and Bahrain. But you have is that the Palestinians want every, look at the text, Palestinian Authority, every inch of what is Israel is Palestine. Why the Israelis continue to allow such things is beyond me, but I don't understand a lot of things that Israel does. I don't think Israelis do either.
That's because we're Americans. Okay.
Anyway, but don't worry. They don't understand why we do what we do. So.
I'm sure that's true. Okay, no, so...
It can't work. It can't work in the end. Here's the only thing in my mind which could possibly ever work, and this is not going to happen. What we have in the Middle East, or what we had historically, was a patchwork quilt, meaning you had pieces which were similar in this place and that place and all sorts of different places. if you had one big state where you voted in a particular area, even if you lived somewhere else, let's say, and that there was general laws for the entire area, I would say from the Southern Caucasus down to Yemen and into Iran and all that, maybe you could do something, but that's it's not going to happen. We know that. So the answer is no. And now, again, I'm part of the problem and not part of the solution.
That's okay, because we have more questions. And if you have a few more minutes, we have a few more questions.
Whatever you want, Shoshana.
So it appears that from the way you presented it, there's not really much of a role for the United States as a mediator, as we have mediated certain other problems. And there's probably then not much of a role for the EU. There's probably not much of a role for the UN. Is it possible that Russia, because it has historical roots there, can force people to come together in a way that makes sense to Russia, which raises another listener's question? Is this the Russians poking things for their own interest?
I can't answer the question about the Russians, did they start it? Because it's a tinderbox, as I said, and somebody could have done something. It could have been someone crossing the street and by mistake touching somebody else, hitting them. I'm serious. This is the level of what this is. It's only an external person, enemy that can do it, and both sides will hate them. In an odd way, if we could, here's the only thing which could possibly make sense. Israel learned that by going into Lebanon in 1982, that if you do what Bernard Lewis, go in, take care of what you need to, and get out right away. Then you can, and the same thing could have happened in Iraq instead of trying to create a 51st state. Go in, let the Iraqis take care of it. If I may be a bit, toot my own horn, I think that of the American government analysts on Iraq, I was close to the best. Let's just leave it there. And I would get on what was going on in Iraq in 2003, and I was there for the war and afterwards, I would get on a scale of 100, I'd get about a 10. I was damn good compared to others. But that's how much we can't get involved in their internal problems. The Israelis learned, thank God, from Lebanon and what they did in Syria, didn't get involved. And if you hurt, their attitude was, if you hurt our interests, we're going to take you out. We're going to do God knows what. But we're not going to get involved in your internal problems. As an American, where you have, you feel sorry for people who are oppressed and this and the other thing like this, that's our, we love the underdog. That's, of course, the smart, that from an American point of view, that's the way to go. But it's not in the Middle East. And Israel went in and took care of its needs, but it didn't take one iota of Syrian territory, and it didn't help this one over that one.
So you've responded to several people who said, why can't the West just ignore this conflict and let the locals play it out until they arrive at their own stalemate? So I think you just explained why that's likely to happen. Although I suppose it is possible that we might want to discuss this with the Russians to prevent it from getting any bigger. I don't know. Could it get bigger? Could other players decide to pop in here? Now, Israel said today that they are not supplying additional weapons to Azerbaijan. They are not entering the war on the side of Azerbaijan.
You're an imperialist against Shoshana.
Sorry?
You're an imperialist against
Shoshana. I'm an imperialist. Okay.
You said
so fine.
Azerbaijan.
Given my role as an imperialist, I point out that Israel has said, as you say, they did in Syria, they're not getting involved in the war. They are friends of Azerbaijan. They have been because of their relationship to Iran or their lack of relationship to Iran. But do you see a possibility that this can be a wider war? And if so, is it possible to prevent that?
Number one, I'm not a prophet. I'm a historian. I have difficulty enough trying to predict the past. If the Iranians, the Iranian Azeris, if there are demonstrations in Tabriz, which is the capital of northwestern Iran, which is pure Azeri, that city, in Iran. If they get out of hand, who knows? There are Azeris who they want to join with Azerbaijan, but inside Iran. I mean, this is normal for the part of the world. It doesn't make any sense. Why would an Azeri want to be, if Persian is an imperialist language, if Persian culture is, which it is, then why would the Azeris want it? Because they originally are the real Persians. The only convoluted logic can put all this together, believe me.
So I'm scanning. We're coming to the end of our time together. And this has been, according to me and according to those who have written in, this has been a tremendous, tremendous learning opportunity for people to understand something that doesn't rise in the media to the level of explaining it to a lot of people. But I always like to end on a positive note. And I always like to ask a question to which the answer is a positive thought. So I don't have one. You know, which puts me right in line with the situation. I don't have a question that lends itself to a positive answer. But here's an attempt at one.
Yes.
We seem to be staying out. It appears that the United States government is staying out. We're not offering to mediate. We're not offering to arm anybody. We're not offering anything to anybody. So are we doing the right thing? Are we being successful right now, the U.S. government?
Given the circumstances, the context here, I think that's the best thing we can do.
Well, then we call that a win for the United States for the moment. Unfortunately, not a win necessarily for the people of the region, but we're going to take our victories where we get them. I'm going to thank you for joining us this afternoon. This has been really very helpful. I know there are questions that people did not get to. What I can do is grab them off the Zoom and send them to Harold. And if he's got the time and he wouldn't mind, perhaps he can answer a few. And say to our...
I'll do it, but what I'm going to do, Shoshana, is I'm going to answer them verbally. I'll send back little messages. You can do with them what you want, okay?
No, that's great. So let me just tell all of our listeners, thank you for joining us. Next week, we are on Wednesday at noon. You will get your invitations. And we hope you will join us to listen to Dakota Wood from the Heritage Foundation talking about the U.S. defense budget. Happily, we are not involving ourselves in other people's wars at the moment, but we still do need a properly organized defense budget, and we need a properly organized military. And Dakota's going to tell you how we get there from here. So watch your mailbox. Your invitation will show up the end of this week, and it will be repeated next week. And we look forward to having you back with us next Wednesday with Dakota Wood. Harold Rode, thank you very much.
Thank you. And Dakota Wood, outstanding. I
yes,
worked
he
with
is.
Him for many years. He's awesome.
He's awesome. Come and join us next week. Thank you.